20 veterans of World War II told their life stories in 2018 as part of South Australia's contribution to the Anzac Day commemoration initiative. They enriched our collective memory accordingly. So strong has been the public response that now another 6 veterans have been interviewed, adding their voices to this exercise in oral history. And so, in 2019, we have the honour of presenting World War II in Words, Part 2. The war itself is remembered as a time of oppression and destruction, lasting 6 years and forever reshaping each society caught in its conflict. In addition, though, it fostered mateship and achievement and honour. In this second series of interviews, our 6 veterans reflect on the emergence of those qualities in that life-changing era. Their words supply an enduring record of service and survival. Long post-war service to the RSL is a prominent feature in the life and times of Laurie Gillespie. He was president of his suburban sub-branch and awarded life membership. In the war itself, as Sergeant Gillespie of the Australian Army Ordnance Corps, later the Royal Australian Army Ordnance Corps, he saw overseas service and had some memorable experiences. We are talking with Laurie Gillespie, and we'll start a bit formally because Laurie's full name is Lawrence Kingston Gillespie. Now, Kingston, very...
Not a racehorse is named after me.
But there was a prominent politician, Kingston, as well.
Oh, Charles Cameron, well, he's someone on the family tree, but we don't talk much about him because...
Go on.
He's not worth talking about. It wasn't the best of characters. He liked the ladies a little bit.
Apparently so.
Yeah, but I don't want to get on that.
With your fine head of hair and your trim figure, I think the ladies would like you to. Right?
I don't know. I loved my wife very much. I never wanted another one. So that makes out a bit there. But so I had 4 daughters too.
Well, we'll talk about those shortly. Yeah. Let's go back though. Lawrence Kingston Gillespie, born 20th of December 1923.
Yeah.
Right, just before Christmas. Whereabouts? Born in Adelaide?
Yeah, born at Mile End. Yeah. Born locally in the Western Districts. That's why I'm living here now. I've always lived in the Western Districts.
Living in the...
Apart from the 5 years I was in the army.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I went to school at Victor Harbour for...
Right.
2 or 3 years.
Let's get on to that.
Yes.
So tell me about your parents. What sort of line of business were your father in?
He married young. He was only 21. My mum was only young. She was a school teacher.
Yeah.
And he married, and let's start off with grandma. Grandmother died when she was about 105, I think it was. And her husband died after World War One. Came home and he was shipped home. He had a, oh, it was something like, he said the trouble all emanated there from the camps they were sent up, and he was over, well over 40 when he enlisted. He was in, worked in the railways at, I think they have to put a something on that where Grandpa, well, I know where it is, but my memory stops at names of places,
sure,
and people, pretty
sure,
much so, except it does go back a long way that way. But anyhow, Grandma ran a boarding house at Victor Harbour.
That was your mother's?
No, my dad's mother.
Your dad's mother, because his father was a World War One veteran,
yeah,
came back sick man,
yeah,
after serving overseas.
No, he didn't serve very long. He was over there a while, and they were all in the staging camps in those days there,
yeah,
in, because of, you know, thousands over there.
In England,
and,
yeah,
and of course, it was always wet over there when he went over there, and then he got a chill there, and it emanated from there. I think I can cover a bit better than that, so just put that down there.
Sure,
Grandpa. And Grandma, of course, had 5 boys and 2 girls.
Right, and what was Grandpa's name?
His name was Lawrence Thomas.
Yes.
And Dad was called Thomas there. Lawrence Thomas he was.
Right, okay. So Lawrence, your grandfather, sick man, died.
Yeah, he died about 1920, just before I was born, about 1922.
Right. And then your grandmother ran a boarding house.
She did, took a boarding house that was owned by her sister.
Right.
And she took it over and went up there to take boarders in. And she was one of the longer residents up there.
And did you go there? Did you stay there or move?
Yeah, I went up there. My mother wasn't too good. It was after we had the Maureen, my sister. She was ill. I never told much about it. Probably some women's complaint, which we don't have to worry about that. But I went up there for 2 or 3 years, and at Victor Harbour, that was a really good country town, and it was a lot better than what it is now. As far as the township went, lovely people. Yep. But there was a high school and another school there, but they wanted to put a Catholic school up there, so the Sisters of Mercy built a school up there. And of course there weren't that many Catholics in the town, but Grandma said, well, send Lawrence up here. She always called me Lawrence, don't put that in there. Lawrence Kingston. I always told the boys at school my second name was Keith.
Yeah. Yes, you're embarrassed to be Kingston, were you?
Oh, yes. Well, I went to school down at Theberton, I'll tell you, that was in the Depression. And Theberton and Mylan were what we'd call now industrial districts.
Yeah, sure.
The railhead and the railway cleaning yards and everything, and all the freezers and that were there, where everything went over refrigeration and that. So that was the light of it there.
Right.
Electric light had the headquarters down there. And I used to walk from the what was called Baggot Street, the Hilton Hotel there.
Right.
I'd walk right down to Theberton here, to past the Queen of Angels Church there, to school. We walked to school in those days. That'd be probably 3/4 of a mile, I should reckon, at least.
So Mum and Dad were living whereabouts? He said Mile End?
Yeah. Dad was living at Mile End, yeah. and Mum was living at Mile End.
Mother was a school teacher.
Yeah, school teacher.
And your father?
Father had when he left school, Grandpa did then, and he had to go and get whatever job he could.
Yes.
The first job he got was as a postal boy on a bike delivering telegrams.
Right.
And from there he went to work in the Torrenside Woolen Mills, which when that was in its peak, made some of the best blankets in the world, with all the way wool was going in those days. And from there, he wanted something a bit better than that. I think he was more or less only a messenger boy there, because most of the girls, most of the staff seemed to be women, I think. Right. Well, it was a factory, and I think women were doing most of the work there in the blankets and that.
And you went off to school at?
I went to school at Theberton.
Theberton.
Yeah.
Theberton Primary, is this?
Yeah, the Theberton Brothers School.
Oh, yeah.
It was a branch of brothers here that this is too involved. You could write a whole bloody book about it. It'd just take you away from what you're,
right.
what you're doing.
It's important. So it was your Catholic family.
Yeah.
Ah, gotcha. So there was a Catholic school.
Yeah.
What was the name of the school there?
Down there, that was called St. John the Baptist.
St. John the Baptist.
And there was an order of men had started an order called the Brothers of St. John the Baptist, and they ran the formatory down there, mainly Catholic boys, and that were sent there to keep the faith and let them know they weren't doing the right thing and whatever.
Gotcha.
Yep. And they did the job there for years, and until the place started to develop there, then the school was taken over, because they wanted a Catholic school in Theberton, and they had all the grounds down there that was there to do it, so that was taken over by the Catholic Education Department, as it was then. I don't think there was much of it there. All this work was carried on at the cathedral, so they took that away from them.
What are your memories of school? I mean, you've been taught by the brothers, and people say they ruled with the Bible and the strap. What was it actually like?
Oh, well, we had good. They were good, solid. Religion was pretty good in those days, you know.
Yeah.
I took the pledge for life while I was down there.
Not to drink.
The Guild of St. John the Baptist,
yes.
Yeah. I didn't have a drink till I was 21. I was up in New Guinea then. The boys saved a bottle of beer from the raffles there once and made me drink it on my 21st birthday. It was lukewarm and everything.
Mortal sin.
Yeah, I'm not a mortal because I was forced to do it. Oh, dear. But anyhow.
Did you go to confession after that, Laurie?
No, they didn't hear about that one. We didn't have a padre in our unit there, but we had... We had a padre. I think we went to the American hospital there, and we used to go to confession at their hospital. And it was there weren't such a thing as you know, big wards in those days. They'd had one lot there. They were in only semicirculars there, right in the middle of there, where all the beds were, you know, looking in there. They had a tree, a little tree there, not a huge one. And he would go there and he'd hear confessions. The boys used to, there was a paper called the Guinea Gold going around at times. I don't know when it came out, but it might have been once a month, I think. It might have come on once a week as things moved on, and then they kept the press in Moresby there.
We better get back to Thebington. As we're speaking, I should explain as you're speaking, you're making some notes, and I don't want to embarrass you, but your handwriting is beautiful, and I know, I happen to know, that you won an award for your handwriting once. Tell me about that.
We're still on that.
Yes, please.
there was nothing to it. I got £10 for that.
So this was a national handwriting competition.
Yeah, £10, one of my uncles, his girlfriend was a school teacher, and she said, "We'll put Laurie in the competition there." Right. So I submitted my writing, and I won the £10, and the girl from Pinneroo came second.
What a beautiful thing to do! Superb. So was this a South Australian or national Australian?
Apple and Pear Board ran it.
Apple and
Pear. Bit of a promotion. I got £10.
Because of your lovely copper plate writing.
Of course, in those days, £10 was a fair bit of money.
What year was that? Do you remember?
Well, that was in 1940.
So you were 16,
I was going to school. I was going out to school at Ross Trevor then. Yeah.
Right.
If you're doing having Catholic education, you went to the Christian Brothers in Wakefield Street.
Right. Yeah.
And I went to there in 1935 and 1940. I wanted to do my leaving, so they could only do it at Ross Trevor. So if you wanted to get your leaving and matriculate from there, that you would be able to do it out there. So I went out there for 2 years, and that's where at Ross Trevor.
Lovely spot.
A beautiful school there.
He played sport. What did you do?
Oh, a man on sport. That's why I didn't do too well in the first. Exams there, and I was told by my mother that I'd played too much. I liked football and running and gymnastics and not so much cricket, but I played cricket there. But no, we all liked it then. But of course, at Wakefield Street in those days, the cricket pitch was out in the park lands alongside the race course. Yeah. So for football practice, we'd have to run from Wakefield Street, where the college is now, all the way down to the park lands to run, and then go back and catch the last tram before 4 o'clock, because your tram passes in those days stopped at 4 o'clock. Right. People started, all the workers were coming home, that was only about 2 and 6 a month then.
You were in the first 18 at Ross Trevor, were you?
Oh, yeah, I was
good
in the
on
first
you.
18.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was an over brilliant footballer, but I was a left footer.
Yeah.
And never a good kick. Yeah. But I played for the first couple of years there, because I was in the first 18 at Wakefield Street.
Right.
And there was only five or six of us that went out there.
Yeah.
And these were the real mates I had out there, because I got to know all the other boys, and we stuck pretty close together. And of course, they all bolted their leavings in, where I was a little bit. I'm not brainy. And I didn't pass all that other subjects to get, so for the last year I was put the board out there, so I went through flying colours, and that's when I turned 17 halfway through December. And,
World War, wonderful life in Adelaide with your tram pass and idyllic way of life in many ways. It was shadowed by war, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was that. And it was, going through the Depression, we all had tough times there.
Yeah.
There was not a great deal of money around. And
and you had mates joining up and getting killed and that sort of thing?
Well, I was usually they're about 16 when they got the leaving certificate there. And I was 17, so I dropped a year, but I went up a year and did the couple of subjects that I needed to get through the other one. You had to get five subjects.
Right.
And I think I got four, and I wanted one, so I did another two to cover the other one. And then I went up to do my leaving there. So I was doing about six or seven subjects, but I really did knuckle down there.
Good on you. So what were your best subjects, can you remember?
Well, I don't know. History seemed to be my best subjects, but I wasn't keen on mathematics. No need to know all that sort of thing. Most people didn't. I liked it up to intermediate stage, but when I got onto logarithms and things like that, that was when it didn't mean much to me. I was doing accountancy there because that was what I was going to do when I left to that school. I was going to do accountancy, possibly economics.
Yeah.
People that did economics, it was included in their course, and it was considered to be quite a good course. But there's another story of that which you'll hear of later on. I had to go at it when I came out of the army.
Well, let's get up to the outbreak of war, 1939.
We'll talk war then.
Of course, let's get into your military career.
Yeah.
Because 1939, you were 16. 1941, you just turned 18.
Just turned 18 and left school there. It was about halfway through December.
Yeah.
At the beginning of January, Lieutenant Mum and Dad down at Victor Harbour.
Right.
At the time, just helping Grandma settle up for, it was a mad Christmas rush down there with the guests. It was a big boarding house by the railway station. It's still there now.
Yep.
But anyhow, this is how I digress. And
I've got the record here saying you enlisted January 6, 1942. According to the Australian Memorial.
Enlisted. Well, that's how quickly it was afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But before that, Mum and Dad were up there helping her a bit because...
Right.
And this is probably... Grandma had to keep the boarding house because she had... one of my uncles and aunties were both legally blind. Yeah. They got an eye disease. It was about... Got to the veins at the back of the eyes, and even these days they couldn't have repaired it. They did try to do things in those days, were a bit primitive, and I think they nearly went off their heads, went off their heads when they were up there. And of course she had to think of them all the time, so she took them up there. There's another story there before they went up there, but
let's get back to your enlistment.
Yeah,
1942.
Yeah.
Can you remember clearly what it was like? You went down...
Well, I can start off from there without any trouble.
Sure.
I'll tell you what, Mum and Dad were away when this bloke came to my front door and knocked on the school.
Yeah.
School holidays had broken down then, and he said, "You, Laurie Gillespie here, lives here?" I said, "Yes, I'm here. What can we do for you?" He's in an army uniform, you see. He said, "Why weren't you down at the drill hall on such and such a date?" And I said... "Oh, I got a letter." I didn't bother to go down. I went to Mum and Dad come down. I said, "It's got something to do with the forces." He said, "Well, yes," he said, you come down to register for the forces."
Right.
And I said, "Oh, so I'm going in the Air Force. It doesn't matter where you're going." He said, "You've got to register."
Right.
So he said, "I want you down there next week at such and such a date." He said, "And if you're not down there," he said, "there'll be two provos in a utility out your front door, and they'll take you down there, and then you're in a bit of trouble right from the start." So I said, "All right, I'll be down there." So down I went, but I didn't tell Mum and Dad about it. Just what happened. They were coming home, that's right.
Yeah.
They weren't home when I went down there. Then they came home, and I went down there, and when I went down to the drill hall at Hindmarsh, they ushered me in there. "Take your clothes off, and we'll get into the little drill hall there." The suburbs had drill halls in those days, and everyone's walking around in the nude,
Yeah.
And the doctor's there, he's sitting down, and they're all coughing and spluttering, and he's open, problem to see if they'd crook behind or something like that. I don't think they tested us for VD and that sort of thing in those days. They come later, but. It was a bit embarrassing. These blokes were running around. Of course, they were all older chaps.
Yeah.
I've got the youngest one down there. But having boarded out there, I was used to running around the shower rooms and things like that. But it was there. When I saw them bend, he was saying, "Touch your toes."
Yeah.
So they go and touch their toes, and then he'd just do that and just have a look around. It's probably to do with piles, I suppose.
Yeah.
So he did that, and anyhow, he said, "You're okay, get dressed." So when we got dressed, he lined us all up. He said, "Now," he said, "we want you all to take on the oath of...
Allegiance.
Yeah, oath of allegiance, that's right. So we all stood up there and we took the oath of allegiance to serve my king at the time, as he was, blah, blah, blah. And he came down, he said, now, he said, I want to see you down at the Wayville next week. He said, you get your uniform there. I said, now, hang on. I said, I'm going in the Air Force. He said, you're not going anywhere except the Army, my boy. He said, now, be sure you're down there. He said, all the Pravos will come up and bring you down there. I said, all right, all right. I said, but I'm going in the Air Force. He said, we'll worry about that later. And of course, when Mum and Dad came home, I told them all this. Oh, that's right. He said, you're in the Army now, and that's what you took then, was the Oath of Allegiance. I said, but I didn't mention anything about the Army. He said, it was the services. Oath of Allegiance, the service to the King, military service to the King, he said. So then when Mum and Dad came home, I said, I'm in the Army. What are you talking about? I said, I enlisted down there, took the Oath of Allegiance. He said, well, why didn't you tell us about it? I said, well, we didn't have I don't know if we had a phone at all in those days. Anyhow, I said, oh, well, I said, you're home. I knew you're coming home soon because you've got to go to work. And anyhow, he said, well, what do you, I said, I want to go in the Air Force. Well, he said, you know, bloody well, I'm not going to let you go in the Air Force.
Did you want to be a pilot?
I wanted to be a Spitfire pilot or some bloody thing like that. Yeah. No, I didn't go that far at all. I just wanted to go in the Air Force in air crew.
Yeah.
And he said to me, Albie's been killed. He said, and Keith's been sent home with in the Air Force up there. That's his brother Albie. So, Keith's been sent home because he did his eardrums. He was an air gunner.
Right.
And with this diving thing that they had, one of his eardrums went on him. He said, so he's gone out of air crew and had been graduated as a chemist before he left. Well, then he went into the, they said, well, would you transfer to the, health side of the air. He said, yeah, that's all right. He said, it'll mean a commission, won't it? He said, oh, well, he said, naturally, he said, if you're a doctor or a dentist, you'd be a flying officer and a pilot, a flying officer you'd be. He said, it's better than being a sergeant air gunner. So I went down and became a lieutenant.
That was your uncle, was that right?
Uncle Keith, that's why I put this here. So, if you're getting onto that side of the family, we'll be here for a fortnight. Right. Now, all the boys there, Grandma couldn't keep the boys. They were still going to school, you see. There were still three boys that were still going to school.
What, her sons?
Yeah, she had five boys and two girls.
Yeah.
And Grandpa was dead.
Yeah.
And, of course, the DVA Veteran Affairs were looking after because this is after the widows and blokes were killed in Gallipoli and that, and they were looking after the wives just after the war was over sometime, and she was giving them help with their giving them help with education, and three of the boys went to school down St John the Baptist down there because she lived at Theberton at the time. Mum lived at Theberton, Dad lived at Theberton. And she, Dad used to milk the cow in the parklands. They had a cow down the milklands. That was his job, to milk that in the morning and the night there. That's what things were like in the Depression. Sure. At their own cow. And when they went down there, they took a horse down there, Dobbin. They took a horse down there with them because they must have had a horse up there at the, I'll think of the name of that railway station, just on the border between Broken Hill and Adelaide. But I think he was in the Piri Railways, and he went further up to one side of
But let's get back to you, and you've taken
you take control.
That's all right.
When I start diverting, because you'll never get over this.
I love your story.
Well, I'm 95 next year, and all this.
But you paint a picture of an age past.
Yeah, that's right.
It's wonderful.
It's so long, but...
It's all right.
Yes, but... Yes, but
I love talking to you, and I'm sure people would love listening to you.
Yeah, but I just know there's things that I don't want to talk about. So
you took the oath. You suddenly, here you were, all intent on joining the RAAF. Suddenly, you're in the Army.
Yeah, that's right. But anyhow, what happened was, when Albie left, the three boys, yeah. Albie and Cyril and Mott Pay, had take their numbers because... Well, I there was the eldest son was Dad, Thomas.
Yes, Thomas, yeah.
And the second one was Charles.
Yes.
And the third one was Albie.
He was killed, you say?
Yeah, I'll tell you about him later. Albie, and he went and studied medicine.
Right.
And Keith left Sacred Heart, and he went and studied chemistry.
Yeah, yeah.
Cyril was boarding there, but Cyril apparently was very backward in classes. Yep. He was not a scholar at all, and he left there somewhere around, you know, when he was 14, I think. It might have been a bit older, but he was a bit of a problem in what he could do, and he went all the way down to He went to work on a farm down at Kybe Bolite down the southeast when he left school.
I know where that is.
Yeah, dear. Yeah. Had a farm there, and it was some ridiculous money, something like 10 and 6 a week or something in his keep.
Yeah.
And he went there milking the cows, you see. And see, now I can digress there for another 5 minutes. And
that's fine. Laurie, just come back there. You've taken the oath.
Yeah.
You're in the army.
Yeah,
somewhere.
That's right. Yeah, okay.
And you come home, you see Mum and Dad. Mum and Dad, I'm in the army.
Yeah.
What happened to you next?
Put Jean and Eileen with the girls.
Jean and Eileen.
Eileen.
Okay.
And the little boy died. Jean and Eileen, you got there.
Yep.
And Eileen, Jean and Eileen, she was with bad eyes, and she had bad eyes, and so did Cyril.
Yeah.
And Jean was a brilliant student, and she went away and did music at the university when she left there. And she got her A-Masai, as they called it.
I remember
that. Music.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Anyhow, we'll get back to...
to you.
Yeah, to Albie, okay. Albie went to the University of Adelaide, and he was a good athlete there.
Right.
Then from there he went over to Melbourne. He wanted to go and study in Melbourne, and he went over there to the university there. I've forgotten the name of that. I'll come back later because I'm trying to think of it now. He went to there. But anyhow, he was a bit of a, didn't know, time was going. He was an athlete too. He was a good cricketer at baseball. Both Keith and Albie were interstate baseballers. I think they're both all Australians too, because Sacred Heart was the home of baseball. And anyhow, he wanted to go over to study at Melbourne. So Grandma said, "All right, well, go over there if you think you'd like to study there." I don't know the reasons for it, anything like that, but he wanted to go over there, and he went over there. And then the next thing is, he wants to go over and conclude his education over in England.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So over he went.
This studying medicine? What was it exactly? What was he doing?
Medicine. He was doing medicine.
So. Yeah.
At that stage, I just don't know whether he wanted to specialise and thought, well, he'd do that over there while all in one hit, then he'd come back with a big bang there.
Exactly.
Well, he went over there, and that's where something, he really didn't know what he wanted to do, I don't think. Now, whether he registered for in a uni or not, I don't know. Oh, gee whiz.
Do you want to take that? It's up to you.
No, I'll just tell him to call back if
okay,
I can.
Mate.
Okay, Grand.
We're back on air now. So,
good.
You're
okay.
Telling me about Albie, your uncle,
okay,
who
well,
wanted to study medicine.
Okay, so he tried different things there, but the next thing we knew was, at that time, things were looking, that was in 1930. He went over in about 1936. I saw him off in the Strathnaver down at...
Just before the coronation. Yeah.
Yeah. And he went over there, and he was killed in 1938.
God.
Now, that was before the war started.
Yeah.
But he went over there, and pretty well must have been there for quite a while, and was running out of what money he had or something, or what he was getting. And he thought, well, I've got to get security, and things weren't going too well. Chamberlain was going over.
That's right.
And trying to straighten things out with
Hitler and Munich.
Yep. And he wasn't getting anywhere. And, of course, he had enough brains in England. Most of the people that had brains and were following it very keenly, like some people would hear that interest in real politics. And he thought, well, he said, I'll go and join the Air Force. He said, I'd like to fly and get in the Air Force. So he went over there. Joined the Air Force. got his pilot's license, and he was flying twin-engine bombers. And in 1938, war was that close that England were having what they called mock battles there, getting their army and their air force, and they had a mock air raid in 1938. Later in the year in 1938, and they did a land exercise with it too, and probably much the size as the big one they did on the landing before they went into France in World War II. They did the landing and the Air Force, and it was a night exercise that he was killed in, and he went up in this bomber, and that's all that information's in that album that I've got there. And I will...
A terrible thing.
Anyhow.
Well, the bomber crashed?
Yeah, it crashed. He and his pilot, the whole crew were killed. Yeah. It turned out to be raining that night, but they all went ahead with it. Vision was bad.
Yeah.
And they crashed into the side of a hill because they didn't have things like radar and things like that. It was all done. And whether the navigator got lost or what happened.
So shattering for the family. Just shattering.
Oh, yeah, poor old grandma, yes. So
in a way, your parents were not keen for you to join the Air Force.
Oh, no way. He said, Albie's been there. He said, please come home, he said.
All right.
He said, I'll tell you what's going to happen. We're moving now.
Yeah.
He says, he said, you join the Navy. He said, that's a good life for you. He said, it's a life for you, nothing like the Navy. He said, a good, clean life, you'll travel and all this sort of business. He said, I want you to get on your bike and ride down to Port Adelaide and go in the division there and find out all about the Navy. So down I go to the bike park. Bike road went all the way down to Port Adelaide. Why they took it away, I don't know. It was on both sides of that centre down there. They were going to take a canal there up to Adelaide. Anyhow, I went down there and I got to the middle of the St Vincent Bridge there, and I pulled the bike up and I thought, we'll have a look around here. I got up there and these boats were, or ships, what do you like to call them, were moored in there, and there was that film you get on the river.
The oil film, and that sort of thing,
an orange peel and apple peel, and look around and I could smell the sea, and I said, hang on a while there. I put the arms over the side there, and I really did have a good old think about this, and I thought, I'm not going bloody in their Navy. I said, I'd be bloody seasick, first day out there. So I turned the bike around in the middle of the bridge, and home I came. Then Dad comes home from work. He said, well, how'd you go, lad? I said, all right. He said, well, who did you see? I said, I turned the bike around the middle of the bridge and I've come home again. He said, well, you're in the damn army.
That's right.
He said, don't even think about the other business. He said, just get it out of your head.
And then you were taken away for training? You did recruit training somewhere, I suppose, did you?
No, at that stage there, I was put in there. We went down and we went down to what they call RRD, which is the Recruit Reception Depot down at Waverley. That's where everyone went down there to get the uniforms. Well, that stage, in January 1942, Darwin had been... Darwin hadn't been bombed, apparently. I went in on the 6th of January. I thought it might have been after Darwin was bombed. No, but anyhow, that was pretty early. I thought it was around the 19th or something like that. Forget that.
Well, Pearl Harbor was December 41.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Pearl Harbor had a lot to do with it, too. Anyhow, he said, anyhow, go down and get your uniform and we'll see you there anyhow. I went down there and what they do down apparently when you've enlisted there, wouldn't have been more than about a couple of dozen blokes when we went down there. They get all your qualifications and that. Yeah. In my case, they want to know where I went to school and what subjects I did and blah, blah, blah. And then from there they go to the recruit reception or something, and you get back to core people, and because core people who have got certain jobs and that, they want them.
Right.
And in my case, they thought, we want tradies, and we want store people, storekeepers, people that know business of everything, because you know what ordnance is all about, don't you? Because it'll come to that. Anyhow, all these things, and also people with clerical experience. Now, this chap's doing his accountancy, he's passed his accountancy. He said, we'll put him on ordnance, you see. So then there were about, I'd say there were no more than a dozen of us at the time, were sent down to Keswick Barracks and right. interviewed there. And I was told that I would be stationed at Keswick Barracks and would do my formal training there and sort it out from there, because ordnance was just building itself down there. And that's another story, of course.
Royal Australian Army Ordnance Corps.
Yeah.
Yep, right.
And anyhow, when I went to RRD, of course, they had trouble fitting you out then. I mean, I couldn't get a pair of shorts. That was summer.
Yeah.
No shorts. And I think I bought my shirt from the people's stores, because I used to work there Friday night and Saturday morning when I was at college, so I could have pocket money, like half the rope. But they all had a lot more money than I had, the kids that went out there, because it was a rather expensive school out there compared to Wakefield Street. Yeah. But anyhow, I went to the people's stores and I said, look, I want a couple of khaki shirts. He said, what the hell do you want? I was in uniform, that's right. What the hell, why don't you get in the bloody army? He said, we can't get enough here. I said, can you get me one? They said, well, why is that? I said, well, this thing has a prickly thing around my neck. I said, and I'm going dancing. I said, and I'm dancing around in this service dress and bloody ankle boots. And I said, and it's bloody hot, and it's hard dancing on a good dance floor with boots. And I said, I've put my civvies on a couple of times, and funny family have gone crook with me. I said, you'll be in trouble if you're caught wandering around. I said, well, I'm not going to dance in bloody prickly uniform. And the old man said, well, you are. Anyhow, I went and told the officer there. He said, I'm running around in my civvies. Ah, he said, get that bloody idea out of your head. I said, well, what's a man supposed to walk around this? He said, well, things are coming up soon. He said, I'll tell you what I can do. We've got a khaki uniform that is left in the ordnance stores there. He said, some of the boys have taken them that are pretty fussy about, the prickly collar and that sort of thing. He said, if you'd like to have one of those, you can get one to fit. Well, you can get one of those till the uniforms are coming through.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I said, that'll do. So I've got the khaki pants and a khaki jacket, and that's done right up there like the cadets are, badges and things like that. And I used to go dancing in that. That was just as bloody hot, of course, but it didn't tickle my neck.
Just tell me about the dancing. I'm interested in this. If I may say, to describe, you're a man of compact build, very slim waist, admirable figure, lovely head of hair. You're an attractive man to the girls.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. You know, all the glitters isn't gold. That's what Shakespeare says. That's what they say to me. Gee, you're looking well for the age. You're carrying your age well. But he's built like that.
Yeah.
God, he said, you carry age well. He put it out of the Anzac Day March last
year. So you went to the dance hall?
Yeah.
Which ones did you go to?
Oh, I went to the ones that we went to when we were in high school.
Go on,
college.
Yeah.
And we went. That was down in the gymnasium at Wakefield Street.
Right.
And of course, all the boys from Sacred Heart and any of the other secondary colleges and that used to go there. And the girls from Loretto and the Convent of Mercy in Wakefield Street would go there because their parents would let them go there.
Yes.
Because there's those days when boys and girls, and they wouldn't let them rock on their own. The girls in those days would be standing at the corner of TNG Building and Curry Street and Grenfell Street and that, waiting for their girlfriends to come along, because they'd all go along in pairs and that. And they'd stand there all night. They would never, ever be chatted or molested or anything like that.
But you'd go to the dance and, excuse me, would you like this next dance that sort of thing? And the Foxtrot and the Pride of Erin and the Gypsy Tap and all
lovely
that stuff.
Yeah.
Did all those?
Did all those, Oh, yeah, they were good.
And walk the girlfriend home afterwards, their partner home afterwards?
Oh, no. We went a motor car in those days. We'd walk them down the last tram.
Yes.
And the last tram used to leave the intersection by the TNG building, and they used to go north, south, east and west. And at 11:30, you'd hear them all going clang, clang, clang. There was a clang, that bloody clanger they had there.
Yeah.
And the boys would come running out from shop doorways and pounding little niches and that, and they'd always put the girls on their tram.
Right. Yes.
That's why they gave the 5 minutes, I think.
I see.
Because that was, you never just said to the girl, see you next week or something like that. You escorted them to the tram and away they went. Then you ran like hell, and sometimes the Hilton tram would be coming down Curry Street. And I would run like bloody hell because I knew I'd have to stop at Colton, Palmer and Preston's to get someone there. That was the railway outfit. The whole street went through there, the railway station. And I'd catch it there, and sometimes I'd miss it. Then I'd walk from Curry Street down to the... Well, people lived in the street behind the Hilton pub down there. That's how can I describe it there? Well, that's where Hilton Bridge is. You cross over there to go down to the airport.
A beautiful story. But now you had this uniform and you went dancing in a uniform.
Yeah.
Good.
All in those days. I went to the Australia Hall and moved out then. Because I sent away for a while, and that was, I'll tell you that later when we get away from this other business. And that's where time was lost for a while. And the boys and the girls, they went on, and some of them went to the Air Force. Vic Grimmett, he went into
the photographer,
he got
Larry's son,
DFC. Wait a minute, I was bleeding.
I had the pleasure of meeting Vic a couple of times later years. Being a cricket fan, I was most interested to meet him because of his famous father, the leg spinner.
Yeah.
And Vic was a delightful man.
He did his full tour, did well over 30 tours and got the DFC. He was one of the classmates that got the DFC. Another one, Brian O'Leary, he got the DFC. And there's a couple of others. They might come in the bank, money bank.
Well, I've taken you away from this area of your enlistment, and you were now going to take specialised Ordnance Corps training.
That was all right. Well, that consisted mainly of going through all the stores and things like that. It probably might be better if you have this general store. Sure. You'll have to meet me again sometime.
Sure. Well, let's just talk about the fact that you were selected because of your education, particularly the accountancy studies, was of value. And you were taken around the stores and you had to familiarise yourself with army store procedures, administration, that sort of stuff.
We worked in the stores, first of all, on the records.
Right.
Because that got to learn as you're going through the rich and the vouchers and everything that were going through and everything that the units were ordering, and what they had stock of and what they didn't.
Right.
And then we were given... In that part there, we were told to go and check the stock, in which case we would get get lists of the stock, and then we'd go all through these ordnance depots to find out what they carried, because everything was in sections in ordnance. Well, it started off with clothing, tools, ammunition. Ammunition was a second, but rifles, gun, mainly pistols, because they... called in all the pistols and binoculars and things like that. They came with some prominent racing horse owners had their names on their goggles and they were all taken in because they wanted them badly.
Right.
And they were there and the revolvers, some beautiful revolvers were turned in there. And everything was being manufactured in South Australia. Everything from kitchen, because the ordnance supplied the fighting man with everything he wanted to keep him on the field, except the ammunition was separate, and the food was done by
Catering Corps.
Army Service Corps. Yes. That's right. And then of course you had the patrolling was done by someone else, and we also did all the motor parts and things like that were handled by ordnance, but the cars themselves were handled by ordnance, but in a different section again. But we were on the supply part, and that we was had to supply the men on the field. That's what it was.
So where did you serve?
First of all, I started for the first time. I was sent away. I was sent to Alice Springs.
Right.
I was sent up there with a Colonel Wilcourt and Captain Colonel Oak and Captain Wilcourt. Three of us went up to Alice Springs because they had started an ordnance camp up there because the Darwin bombing was over and that was starting to consolidate itself. They still had to worry about Darwin because Kokoda hadn't been settled then.
Right.
And they were frightened if Kokoda fell, the first place that we would be going to was Darwin.
Sure.
And of course from Darwin... the train only went to Elliot, I think it was, and from Elliot down to Alice Springs was dirt road.
Yeah.
And from Adelaide down from Alice Springs down to Adelaide, the train gauges changed. So to get stuff up to Darwin, you had to go through Adelaide, and then change trains at I told you the name a while ago.
In the Northern Territory, Elliot?
Yeah, no, this is the first Port Aquila. I just had changed everything in the narrow gauge at Tarawi.
This is just before Port Pirie?
Yeah,
yes. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's where Tarawi is called, isn't
it?
Yeah,
is.
Tarawi, that's right.
That's it.
So I was sent up there once too. And so I had to go there, Tarawi, change gauge, go to Alice Springs, shipped again onto the narrow garage you could take as far as Elliot, and we had an ordnance rail head there that was run by just a few blokes, and from then it went to Elliot, from there it went by road transport further on, and all the trucks that used to go up and down from Darwin to Elliot, you'd see them come down, new Internationals and new Fords and that, and the drivers would take the bonnets right off them because they said that the motors heat up quick enough. I said, we don't want that. So they'd go down with the radiators protruding on a nice section. And when you'd see them coming back, because we were on the track and coming back, we'd see these trucks coming. Look at the bloody wreck on that one, because they'd be going at 60 miles an hour all the time. And, of course, the country road boards up there, the civil construction school, and we should call them curtains cunning so-and-sos. Nasty word. CCC, yeah, there's one of the curtains coming, so I said, yeah, I was saying, that terrible bloody word we're talking about. And then they had to interchange up there, and they you say it was an ordinance at Elliot. It wasn't a big place, but they had to transship all this stuff because they were all there were all trucks going up, the international trucks and that, and all laid with stuff, and they had to be separated again.
So what was your job specifically, keeping a record of this transport?
Yeah, well, this is what ordnance is all about. I was sent up there, but they were bringing in what they called the English accounting system up there because it's getting too big for them. But up there, when I first went in, they took us over to the motor division there, and that's why they called it the motor division, which is the sheep pavilion over at Waverley.
Yes, sure.
And all those sheds were taken over, and all the automotive parts went there. They were all Jeeps. Every sort of car that was on the Chevrolet, everything was on there. And we were sitting around at a big table, and there were the great big journals, that heavy, and they all had every item that was in there had those papers on them. Right. And you'd be, first of all, working on them, putting them in and out sort of business. And you'd say, down, who's got part number so-and-so to so-and-so book? You can have it in about 10 minutes. All right, well, yeah, right, I'll wait for you. And there's this row of chaps here, and they were doing all the motor parts. Well, then I did the motor parts for quite a while there, and it was a terrible shambles, ordinance. It's hard to describe. But then the English accounting system came in, and that's when they got about 12 of us, and they formed us into an audit system.
Right.
An audit system, and then we had to go around and check all this English system going in there, and make sure that it went into the quartermaster's. Quartermasters were stored up with, and they had to know about it too, how they ordered and back orders, and don't ever over order just because you want to build up on something like that. And so I went up there with Buffoist, to call our captain, went up with Oakey and Wilcourt, and I was up there about 3 months, I think.
It's Alice Springs?
Yeah, Alice Springs.
Yeah, right.
And we were in the camp there. And there were a lot of Victorian boys up there, and they were all blokes that had been conscripted, lads about my age, who had a lot of fun up there. And
you say you had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Oh, well, boys will be boys,
you
know. Well, it was called the larrick in most of the things.
Yeah.
Some would be trying to pinch stuff if they could, you know. They were never thieves in the army, you know. They were scroungers.
Scroungers, right. But you'd taken the pledge not to drink, so you weren't drinking.
Oh, no, I wasn't drinking, no. Well, I don't think many of them drank up there, because they're on six and six a day then.
Did you get to play a bit more football up there?
Yeah, but we had to go into the town. No, we didn't have any sport there. We had to go into the town for mess and that sort of thing.
Right.
And all it was a staging camp there, and the Aboriginals were all put into khaki.
Yep.
And they were called Jackie 1, Jackie 2, Jackie 3, and every morning when we'd go down to get breakfast in the big hut there, flies were terrible, everything was inside gauze wiring there. And
can imagine.
The staging camp was next door, and the blokes said, the Jackies are lining up now, and Jackie there and the bloke ticking them over, say, Jackie 1, here boss, Jackie 2, here boss, and here boss. They say, Jackie so-and-so, where's Jackie so-and-so? He's not here, boss.
What was their job? What was that happen?
Well, they used to go into the transport part there, and they all had the folding camp bedsteads. Bedsteads camp folding. Everything had to be under the main now. Bedsteads camp folding. So what they used to do was they used to clean the tents. They had all dirt floors on them.
Yeah.
And the boys would be smoking and having sweets and all that sort of business. They couldn't drink. Beer was never allowed on the camp, and I never saw anyone drinking beer up there. The sergeants didn't have a mess there, and the officers' only mess they would have got into, because the hospital up there had a lot of sisters up there, and they had a mess, of course, and a bit of social life in the hospital, so all the officers naturally got to go over there and meet the girls and things like that, so they might have got to beer, but no one else did, so we would go in the town there. But anyhow, the boys...
Did you get any rank out of this?
I was a corporal. Corporal. Up there, yeah. Got a corporal there after... I got a corporal with...
So you were corporal, Gillespie,
and
you were in Alice Springs.
Yeah, I made a corporal pretty early in the piece. That's got my AB 83 in it. It was about halfway through the year, I think, anyhow. Right.
We're well into 42 now, well done 42 now.
Yeah, 42, I was in 42, yeah. And I didn't come a sergeant until I was up in New Guinea.
Well, tell me about that now. You're Northern Territory, middle of 42. What happened after that?
Well, then... I went there, and then when I came back there, at Tarawi, that was the staging camp there, and there were hundreds of troops there, and that's where there was beer, but that was all in camps and that, but they couldn't get rid of them, and of course planes weren't available much in those days. Even what's his name, the American
MacArthur
had to come down by rail.
Yeah,
he even come down on the. What was it called that took us up there? The GAN.
GAN, yeah.
I think he wondered what he struck.
Exactly.
And they caught it at Tarawi, and down they went, mum and the kid. And yeah,
that's right.
We went to Tarawi for a while, and we settled a bloke up there, because he was having pretty big demands on the queue store there, because the blokes went up there, they'd want this and want that and run out of something else, or someone pinched some of their clothes. And so we went up there, and that was in a hell of a mess.
Yeah.
And that woman up there with a sergeant. They made me a sergeant to go up there, but not officially. They said, look, you're going to be a sergeant when you get up there. I said, let me in the messes. And he said, yes, you'll be a sergeant. He said, but don't go telling anyone you're not a sergeant. I said, that's not going to be too bloody good, is it? Well, do as you're bloody well told and get up there. I said, all right. So I went up there, and it was in the summer, I think. I think I had an armband. Used to have an armband with rank on it then, you know. And I had my SD jumper jacket up there, and I had the corporal stripes on it then. And I said to Madigan, he was a sergeant, I said, for God's sake, I said, don't let on that I'm, you know, because I was eating in the mess.
Yeah, acting sergeant, that's all right.
Yeah, that was all right. But at that stage at 18, I was just starting to wean myself into it, you know, what life was like. I tell you the first thing, look, I could talk for ages on this, and I've got to go out after lunch. But anyhow, first thing I noticed, I went to Waveville, because we were on subsistence then, and until you got your uniform, went into there to get your uniform, until you got them. And when you went to the toilet there at Waveville, you go into the toilet, and they had no doors on there. So there they were, this rows of about a dozen toilets, and the blokes were all sitting down there. The urinal was opposite that, so the boys were having a leak, and they'd be talking over their shoulders to someone, saying, would you get leave this weekend, so-and-so, or whatever? No. And he said, and I was sitting like that, I think, this is funny, you know, because at least at boarding school, we had doors on our, on our toilets. But when we got overseas, of course, they used to dig them with the bulldozer, and then the pioneers would come in and build the scaffolding of them, and there'd be 12 or 20 even in them. We'd all be running in there, and then right at the end there, they'd build a box there, and that's where they used to keep the Smith's Weeklies and the Truths and all the magazines and papers. The boys would be sitting down and said, have you got an Advertiser or a Truth? Or Smith's Weekly was the paper, and the Truth was the Adelaide one with all the scandal. Remember the Truth? Yeah, Scandal magazine. And they'd be sitting down, they'd be grunting. And I thought, oh my God, thank you. Anyhow, we talked about that. The terrible things you have to do, you know. I'd try and go overnight time. There's only about half a dozen out there, but you can't do that anyhow. Now, we're talking about...
Well, we've got you now as an acting sergeant up at Tarawi.
Oh, you forget all about that. Don't put that in there, whatever you do. That wouldn't be fair.
But what happened after that?
I went back to... that's right, they were going to send me to the prisoner of war camp where the Japs were.
Cowra. At Cowra. Yeah.
And one of the officers at Keswick Barracks near Dad. Yeah. And he rang him up, and Dad worked at Charles Burke's in there, had a pretty good job there.
That's the big department store in town. Yeah.
And anyhow, he rang him up. He said, "Tom," he said, "I've had a word with Bill Wilcourt." He said, "Laurie's too young to send up that prisoner of war camp." He said, "He have enough going for him here." He said, "Do you mind if I stop him from going up there?" And Dad said, "No." He said, "Don't send the little bugger up to me." Send him up there. That's what he said. "Don't send the little bugger up there." He said, "No." He said, "Well," he said, "it's not the place for someone like that." He said, "Because," he said, "there's all Japs up there." He said, "Never know, you know, what'll happen there." Anyhow, trying to get around the right way to do something, you know, the little boy do something, because I looked pretty young then. So anyhow, I didn't go there, but I was going to be made a sergeant to go up there.
Right, I guess.
And that's when I was told that I wasn't going there. They changed their mind. It was a better place for me.
So what was the better place? What happened next?
Well, then from there, we moved around all these units were being formed. You see, this 6 months, all sorts of places. Because everything was being done at Queensland and New South Wales. Victoria was the big, you know, manufacturing place for ordnance with clothes and all that sort of thing. And very little. We did a fair bit of, when we settled, the clothing industry was did a marvellous job keeping Darwin going and that. And of course, in that case, very few people got out of Keswick, because they wanted them there.
Right.
And they were taking them. They even sent them some over to Western Australia. And when we went up there, they wanted some to go further on from Moresby. We were sent to Moresby first, and there they were sending us on. But then they wanted to send a contingent of, oh, I don't know how many, I've forgotten the number, but they were going to send a contingent from all states, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia, and Adelaide. And they were taking numbers from there. I think there couldn't have been more than a couple of dozen left from here on a troop train that went away in that contingent. But in Western Australia, there were about at least 10 or a dozen blokes that had been sent over there, because they were carrying the schools over there. It was all about shorties and that. What happened? They'd been over there about 10 months, I remember that well. And when they came back here, we were waiting for them up in Brisbane. We were 6 weeks leave in Brisbane.
Now, let's get to that. So you were sent to Queensland?
Yeah.
Ah. And what were you doing up there?
Well, we were waiting for everyone to join us.
Around the country?
Yeah. When everyone was coming from Queensland and Victoria.
Yeah.
But Queensland, of course, they were there. But there weren't many from Queensland there. There were a few, because I knew someone that came from up the Gold Coast.
But you were posted up to Brisbane, and then there wouldn't have been a lot of activity there because of the Battle of the Coral Sea.
I'll go off again there. But anyhow, I just finished that. What happened to the boys at Western Australia? They had to come straight through Adelaide after 10 months and not have any leave to even go and see their loved ones. Imagine folks that had fiancés and wives and things. So they sent straight on, because we were waiting for them up there. So it took 6 weeks to get there.
You were waiting in Brisbane to get the whole contingent together.
That's right. We're all there except Western Australia.
To go to New Guinea, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm with you.
Yeah, we sensed we were going to New Guinea when we went away, but I didn't tell Mum and Dad that, because I did put in to go away there. When I got back from Alice Springs, this is why probably before you start taking your notes, you talk to me, because when
well, that's all right. We're doing just fine. Yes, we've got you to Brisbane.
Yeah.
And what sort of period, therefore, can you remember the date that you got to New Guinea?
We left here in July.
Of 43, yes.
And we arrived in New Guinea on the evening of September the 26th, We went down to the 17 mile. We were posted to 17 mile down the track.
Right.
And raining cats and dogs. Fortunately, there were people there beforehand. They put up tents for us, but there were no beds or anything like that. So we had to sleep on the ground. Right. And it rained all the way. They're all standing up in trucks and things like that.
Down the track?
It was a road, but a road they were going down there. It was a wide enough road to take all these tracks. The Americans, especially the Negroes driving, they were going down there 60 miles an hour in that time. And we used to hitchhike with them. To think how mad we were, because there was always a big rail up the top where they put tarpaulins. If it was raining, it was just high enough for us to hold onto the bloody things while they put on the speed. And they used to think it was a big joke. They'd be going down there, and then someone at the track would be, you know, saying they want to go on, and they would always pull up for the Aussies. You know, they'd always be picking up, going up.
Hitching a ride.
It went right up to about the foot of the Owen Stanleys there. Right. But anyhow.
So this is...
I'm getting excited.
Very animated, 1943. It's New Guinea, it's hot, it's wet. What about malaria? That was a risk, surely.
All right, that's where I was going on. The next morning, the bloke said, well, there was a tent next door. They might have put up it was a very good tent that had a very good... I've forgotten the name of them now, but that goes over the...
Fly. The fly tent?
That's right, yeah, the fly. Yeah, that was very tight. And what happens with those, if it rains too much, sometimes the rope tautens on it, and the next thing is it pulls everything out the ground, you stand up with nothing. Then he said, who put these up? Well, the boys down the line did yours there. He said, sorry, there's no beds for you. And I said, well, at least it's dry. He said, well, they built those tunnels. He said, we're on the side of the slope. Yeah. All that water's going down there so you don't get wet there. I said, it's feeling bloody wet in here. We went to bed with our palliasses and used our ground sheets, you know, and the blankets and that. The next morning I woke up and the boys said, the bugle went for breakfast, all our bugles there. And they said, hurry up, it's breakfast. And I'd woke up that morning and I put my tongue inside my mouth there. I was talking like this, you know, and I said, hell, I won't be able to eat it. We have a look inside my mouth. And I opened my mouth and it's full of bloody blisters.
Yeah.
And I said, well, we had no nets last night. I said, I reckon something bloody will bit me. Have a look at this. Shit, he said, you better get the only place. Do we know we got one? I said, well, we're going to breakfast anyhow, Gilly. He said, I'll find out for you there. In the meantime, one of the other blokes came through and he could hear what was going on there with me. He said, what's up with you? I said, I've got to go to the ROP. Where is it? He said, oh, it's about a quarter of a mile down the track there, down through the Kunai. He said, the track through there. He said, just walk down to the end of your lines here, follow the track and they'll be there. They've got tents and things like that there. So he said, what's up with you? I said, well, I don't know, have a look. God's truth, he said, I've never seen anything like that here. So down I go and I thought, truth, I've got a disease here. So down I go to the ROP and the blokes said, what's up with you? I said, I can't talk, I can't eat or anything. Let's have a look. Oh, hell, he said, you're an ambulance job. He said, don't stop that ambulance, will you? I said, why is that? He said, well, the Aussie hospital is just down the road here. He said, you better go there and have it seen. So that's where I went there. I was in there for 2 months.
What was wrong with you?
Well, they didn't seem to know. They were calling it everything. They called it eventually stomatitis. So I said, I was all right coming over on the ship there. I said, and we were on the water for 3 or 4 days. I said, because we didn't have sub escort and we weren't going mad there. It was a ship that used to take the people from Tasmania to Melbourne. Sort of one of those ships. I've forgotten the name of it. Anyhow,
what was that term again? Something matitis. Give me that name again.
Stomatitis.
Stomatitis.
That's what they said. Okay. It was. That wasn't up there because I couldn't see what it was. Right.
Very unpleasant.
Yeah. Eventually, when I could get out of the, because I couldn't eat there, I was being fed with a glass tube, all the liquids and that. And when I could get with the bed there. Get out of bed and walk a bit. I was allowed to. I didn't wanted to. There was nothing to do otherwise. You're getting all, bed pans and things like that. I've lost it. There's something important.
You're in hospital.
Oh yes, I got at my chart one here, and they put it down as staphylococci, one of these staphs and that. Yes. So all I did was, because in the meantime. you could be writing a book, because in the meantime I hadn't written Mum and Dad from Brisbane. Yes. And I just said to them, I said, you won't be hearing from us for a while now, because we're moving on and we're not allowed to say where exactly. we're going and we don't know where we're going. Well, we knew where we were going. So I said, just hold on and I'll give you a drop of a line as soon as I get up there. Well, I wasn't in the condition to write. I suppose I could have got writing paper. There's nowhere to write it anyhow. After a week, when things were starting to come just a little bit normal, other things, I said, there were sisters, our nursing sisters there. And I said, can you get me somewhere I can let my parents know that I'm in hospital? She said, yes. She said, but you can't put you can put the name of the hospital. You have to put it down as being in Australia.
Yes.
Let me see your envelope. We'll get you an envelope from now. So
with your beautiful handwriting...
I wasn't beautiful in bed, I can tell you. So anyhow, what happened there was...
you got better?
I hope so, yeah. I wouldn't go to the rehabilitation, though. I wanted to get back to the unit, because I knew the boys were going to split up. And I didn't want to be separated from the lads. There was only about four or five my age there, and one of the lads that was I went to school with him at Wakefield Street. So Teddy King, we knew each other from years back, and Murray Hales, they both died in their 70s, and Murray Hales was at Keswick Barracks, and he was working with me along with those other things there. He was younger than me, about... about 3 or 4 months so he said, now I'm the young bloke here, I've got to get that sweet FO, you know. Well, I had to swear like the rest because of the man. But anyhow, I was there, and when I came to a way where I could move around, you could write a book on what was going on in the bloody ward, because it wasn't a ward, there was just a tent about... would have had about 15, 16 beds on that side and on that side, and then there like that, because there weren't enough beds to bring them down there. So anyhow, I got a job there when I got mobile of filling up all the water jugs every day. Right. And because I got weak with this not eating much there, I used to nearly be exhausted when I finished the bloody thing, because everyone wanted to refill their water jugs and that. And all had to be special water, you know, not special, but at least they knew it was coming from the water tanks they put up there and then come through a water softener or something, I don't know. But no one got the shit expression out of it. But anyhow... that's the job I got there. And then another day when I did that, one of the nursing sisters came and said, will you take their temperatures for me? Right. I said, well, she said, you have yours taken every day. Everyone has to have their temperature taken every day. I said, we're short-staffed here now in the air. I said, I can't do it. I've got this and that. So when you're doing the water, will you take their temperature? Take all their bloody temperatures. Anyhow, that's getting on us.
Oh, it's an interesting stuff. It's all colourful, it's all informative.
Yeah, but
you got better, you got over this stuff.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to the doctor. He said you've lost a lot of weight. Yeah. I said, well, I haven't been eating much, and what I'll get there is, you know, rat shit. Another saying, that's a Victorian saying, rat shit. We're all bullshit, but rat shit was Victorian. And he said, you really, really should go. No, I said, I want to get, he said, why do you want to get back there? I said, they're going to move on. I said, and I don't want to be left on my own, I said, because there's nothing worse than rolling up in a unit and not knowing anybody. I said, and I I'm going to miss those blokes if I don't get this. So he said, all right, he said, but he said, go there in the first couple of days. He said, if you're not feeling all right, just come back here. He said, I'll be in a bit of trouble.
Right.
So anyhow, back I went, and I walked back there. The unit wasn't far away from the bloody place. And I got back there, and I found my tent, and there was no bed there for me. And I thought, sure, I want to be in bed with the boys, because we stuck together all that time. Anyhow, one of the boys said, I've got to get a bed made somewhere. I get it. He said, there's an iron bedstead, Camp's folding bedsteads, down there. He said, but he said it hasn't got any palliasse or anything to go with it. And it's only the wire. He said, we don't use the palliasse. We use our blankets for the for the mattresses because you didn't want blankets up there. Only when it rained, you put them on and think you'd make out your home, and it was raining and you were cold. And anyhow,
So you got back to the unit, you got back to the boys.
I got back there, yes, and we'll just not go on from there, because I've taken you way away from where you should be.
Well, that's okay, because we've taken you through an unpleasant period of illness in hospital.
We got up there on September the 26th and went straight down there in the trucks and everything like that. And from there, I was put into what they call the control office, and the chap says, you're going to be on the auditing staff that you were on down there. He said, all the things were parabolics, like the parabolics we called them, but they're Nissen huts, they're called down here. All the migrants had to sleep in them and that. And that's where everything was stored, and it was kept pretty dry, and the wet would come down like that. And the boys that were looking after, always two of them looking after it, they would sleep there. They had the advantages of sleeping under cover and that. Because if they didn't, well, people come in and pinch it. We used to have perimeter and pickets there. Yep. You always had to have someone going around there, barely in teams of four, to take it on all night sort of thing. And that was spooky bloody work too. I didn't take that too well.
But we've got you now. You've turned 20. You've been in New Guinea a while. You've got this job. And whereabouts geographically have you moved to?
I was 20 when I went up there. That's right. I was going to say I was older than that. No, that's right. Yeah. Well, I hadn't turned 20 then, because I had my 20th and my 21st birthdays up there.
Okay.
I was up there nearly two years.
21st birthday was the occasion you had a drink. Is that right?
Yeah.
You had a beer.
A bottle of beer. It was lukewarm too. I was singing and dancing.
Did you like it?
I was bitter, you know. Yeah. And of course, I drank it out the bottle.
Out the bottle, yes.
This would be the worst thing to do, is drink warm beer.
Was it? A Melbourne bitter? Do you remember what it was?
Oh, it was some. They used to call it Tiger's Piss. We all got everything there, because the best stuff went to the messes and things like that. We only used to get, I think it was two bottles, and I didn't drink after that.
Did you get to see the enemy, Japanese at all?
No, only the prisoners of war that come down. Because I used to like to hog the airfields.
Yes.
Wood Strip and Jackson Strip were only probably about five or six miles down from where we were. They were at the 17 mile. And that's where their wardrobes, that's where their aerodromes were. And I used to break away and Sunday was always a day of rest up there, which we were very lucky, you know, those days. And I would just get out, get me breakfast and say, see you later, boys. And they said, where are you going? I also got an airstrip. I like watching the...
And you'd hitch a ride down the airstrip.
Watch the bombers taking off and all that sort of thing. And I could, but then they'd have to go off the road to get there, but you could see them from the road, but I wanted to go down.
There was a massive incident, a big crash, wasn't there?
That's what I was going to
say. Major disaster.
Yeah, I was in hospital when that happened, and they all brought them up there to put them in there. And I wasn't mobile then, and there were over 60 odd killed, I think.
Exactly.
I've got the whole history of it in that album that I've got there. And it's not a photo of the plane, I think it's a photo of the trucks and that, where they were there. But it came through the wards, like, oh, there's been a bloody mess down here, Moresby, what's up? They said the bloody Liberator crashed into six or seven trucks that were waiting to fly over to bloody Nadzab or somewhere like that. Because that stage there, I think, WOW had just been finished. Yes. And then they were moving on to the Finchhaven was going to be the next. Lay was to be the next one. That's where I went to Lay from Moresby.
Liberator crashed into a lot of trucks. A lot of Australians.
No, Moresby. Huh? Moresby. Yeah, there, yes, yeah. Yes. I think it was American Air Force they were flying in.
So you were then posted to Lay?
No. I was there for quite a while. And then I was in Moresby for 5AOD, they called, 25th Ordnance Store Company, that was.
Right.
And then they put me on to the 43rd Field Ordnance, and I knew that I was going to be shifted somewhere, so I got shifted to Lay, and that was a very quick job. The two battalions, the 6th and the 9th, were there, And when it was over, they moved back home pretty quickly. I think there's another show after that with the losing facts. They moved on pretty quickly there to Finch Haven. And I don't think there was an ordnance depot at Finch Haven. But Lay was consolidised pretty quickly. And we're always by rivers there. Always with the Beauty Bum in Moresby and the Loki in Lay. And we were always near the creek because we could get the water. We put up big tanks and pumping things, and then we would operate. Well, it always had to shower on it. Sometimes we'd go down to the river down there and do it.
In the latter stages of the war, 45, where were you then?
45, I was discharged in 46. 45, when we came home, went into the barracks again.
You say home, you're talking about Australia or New Guinea?
No, the homes, it was Australia.
So let me just take you back first, though, because you were still in New Guinea when Japan surrendered, August 45?
No, I was at an officer's training school then at... a big country town in the middle of Victoria.
Bakapanyo?
No. This is a big town there. Where the school is quite a big school of us there. We went up there to do our ammunition course, and we were up there for about 5 or 6 days. Yeah. I just don't know how long. And when we were sitting on the station the next morning to go home, someone raced up and said, "You wouldn't read about this." I said, "What's happened?" I said, "They've bombed." It was the atom bomb.
Yes.
The boy said, "It's what?" Oh, stop bullshit. He said, "It's bombed." He said, it's 100 times worse than Bloody Darwin, they say. And one of the blokes said, there were half a dozen Dutch boys were doing the course with us too, because the Dutch army somehow became involved with ours. And they said, "Well, we're going bloody home, you know." And they said, "Well, this is all right. We're bloody well going home." And he said, "Forget it." And the chap there in charge of us, he said, "Forget all about going home." He said, "You'll be finishing the course." He said, "You'll be going to be around for bloody months yet." And anyhow, I'd fallen short of him because I had a few nuts to drink in the sergeant's mess the night before that we went away. Anyhow, that was that.
So you'd come back from New Guinea in 45?
Yeah, and there.
And back to Australia?
Well, in that case, from there, I went back to ordnance.
But you were selected for officer training?
Yeah, it was a couple of us used to go every now and then. And officer selection.
Selection board.
Selection, not trained.
I see.
Well, it was much the same thing. It was updated on ordnance procedure and business.
Right.
Because a lot of them there, a lot of officers were made to do the course from not only in our units, and the Dutch were made to do it because they had to know about it, so they thought, well, there's always room for, because everyone was trying to get out of the army then, and the officers were trying to get out of it. Some of them, those that didn't have better jobs, were staying in, and they had to put a few officers in to carry on.
I thought of the name of that place, Bunagilla.
No. It's I'll think of it later.
We must find it.
Yeah,
it's that was a famous camp too.
I'll find that out.
All right.
Yeah, there's a big one there. Anyhow.
So you hadn't completed when.
Not my course.
You hadn't completed your course when Japan surrendered.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what happened from there, because there are only two of us doing the course from Adelaide.
Yes, right.
And we went back there, and one of the lesson beginners. He stayed. He was at Alice Springs. He stayed at Alice Springs all the war, and he was sent down. And he loved it at Alice Springs. I said, "So you bloody well Lord." I said, "I couldn't get out of there quick enough, because I knew they had to stay up there 2 years without leave, because they couldn't get them home. There's so many troops up there, and the trains didn't go all the way, and there wasn't room on trains in there because the stuff coming and going. Planes were still wanted up as a battle would go on, so you were really locked up there." But, and that's how I got on the draft, really. I went to the captain, and when they left Alice Springs, I went to there this morning, and I went into the control office there, and I said, "Where's Buff? I haven't seen him today." And one of the warrant officers said, He said they'd gone back to Adelaide. I said, that's the bloody thing they would do too. He said, no, dig him. He said, Boffin Oaks caught the train from the railhead last night. He said, and the lieutenant, I forgot his name. He said, he came here and collected them and sent them off.
Did you call him Boff to his face?
No, no.
He's a World War One man.
Okay. And he was didn't know a great deal about ordnance at all. He was there just to control the staff and everything like that.
But the war went on for a long time because Japan surrendered August 45.
Yeah.
But I've just looked at your records here from the War Memorial. You were discharged 19th of September 46.
Yeah.
So you were in for a long time, another year.
Yeah. Well, what happened there, that I was brought back again, and then I was put in the Keswick Barracks here again in the Ordnance Head there. And then eventually they said, well, the bloke at the parade ground in town, he said, wants his discharge.
Right.
He said, and he's cutting up about it a bit. He's had a good job here all the time. He hasn't been out of the office there. But he said he's in charge of all the clothing material here for South Australia. And he's gone. And Robbie said, we can't get anyone to take his job. And now you've had a bit of accounting experience. So I said, well, that's got enough to do with money. There's no money involved there. He said, no. But he said, there had a lot of work done with yardage and supply and that. He said, so he said, we're going to put you up there. I said, I suppose it was a promotion because I'd been made a sergeant. I was made a sergeant in New Guinea, but I didn't get my stripes till I come home.
Right.
And I think that was, 6 months later.
Yeah.
Yeah. I said, what about putting it in my pay book? They said, well, it's got to go through headquarters. I said, that's ordnance all over. Anyway, when we came home, Captain Stuckey, he was the boss of ordnance then, Major Stuckey, he lost his leg. He was in the 27th Battalion, lost his leg over in Africa. So he was put to a local job here. And Stuckey, a pretty good, big name in Adelaide at that time, got the job as DADOS, Deputy Assistant Director of Ordnance Services. And when he came home and he wanted to see us all there, and he said he was put there before I left. He was put there under Oak. That's right. When Oak left, because Oak had a pretty job and simple life, he was an older chap. He went there and he had called us up because he'd known all of us before we went away. He said, hell, he said, you blokes can't be very good. You're not very good yet. He said, no one's gone up in rank or anything like that. I said, no, the establishment made us such. I said, it's come down there to be done. And I said, we've never got them. He said, never got them. I said, no, we haven't got them. He said, this is happening all the time. He said, this is the bloody ordnance corps, because it is a... Well,
it's supposed to be highly efficient, isn't it?
Well, supposed to be, yeah, but it is not. It's all right up their job.
Yeah.
But apart from that, you'll find it happens in those jobs, particularly during the war, that the boys that were put in, got the commissions when they went in, were chaps that worked in the automotive industry. If Blake was the manager of the spare parts department in an automotive industry, he was made the manager of the lieutenant in the parts section. If he knew a bit about the car trade, he was put in or selling cars, knew a bit about valuation or something like that, or he was a sales manager, well, they usually a bit older than what they wanted at the top. But anyone that was about age, they took him in because at the time they were taking cars off the road. If anyone had a late model Chevy or a Ford, sorry, give us the keys. We want that one for the army. So they'd have to hand it over. That was the last model that went out. They wanted the cars to let people run around here because the cars were going over there. Of course, the Yanks wanted cars. And at that time, early time when that all started, I think they were too busy getting troops over here rather than relying on Australia to...
So you soldiered on throughout 46, and eventually you went back...
There, anyhow, what they said to me, you're being put in charge at Torrent Drill Hall, and that's where I went, and I got all the charge of all the clothing contracts that were done in relation to the Wayville, where the pay corps was, and which was the financial side of it, and that's where, before anyone got paid for making uniforms or anything like that, I had to sign, make sure that the all the material was used, and also the fact that we didn't let some loose there. And it did happen a couple of times, loose, and we found out we're shortage in town then.
Were you anxious to get out of the army, or were you happy to stay?
Oh, I was in the end, because I was nearly 23.
Yes.
And never worked in my life.
No.
And I thought, well, you know, I didn't even feel like studying then. I could have gone on to uni, and I, And I'd got used to knocking around, you see. That's when I was drinking, when I came home with the boys.
Yes.
Because when they came home, I was in the last six to come home. The other boys would be home about a month before I got home. And I thought they're going to bloody well keep me up here because they could only send a little bit home in the Douglases and that, because other people had to go home beside us. So they used to put probably about 20 in or whatever they held in the plane, and you would all sit opposite each other, facing each other along the fuselage, and go from there.
So come September 46, you had to reinvent yourself, become a civilian.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So what did you do?
Well, I went up to the you could go and do anything you wanted to, and they would pay you, you know. So I went up there and told them that I wanted to finish my accountancy, because I only went to a certain stage, I only went to company accounting at school.
Right.
They said, well, that's all right, you can do that. What do you want to do? I said, I don't want to do it full time. I said, I can't tie myself down. I said, I'm tied down, I want to live. I said, you know, I haven't knocked around much. And that meaning dancing and socialising, and I didn't have a girlfriend then. Never had much in the way of girlfriends. I said, this way of life, I just don't want to tie myself down for be at least another 3 years, you know, full time. And my mate Murray was doing his part time, and he had a child at the time, because he'd married, he'd got engaged before he went away. And Ted had got married, and I didn't even have a girlfriend. That worried me much. But I said, I'll have to do it part-time. So that's what I did. But in the meantime, what had happened to me, the blokes that I went to school with and all, you know, matriculated, had done their going to uni, and they ended up lawyers, doctors, dentists. One was a city coroner. Len King was at Sacred Heart College when he was a pretty prominent solicitor. But anyhow, he was the city coroner, and they were all going through, but they were brains, you know. I knew they were brainy from school, and I was fighting to keep up with my lectures. And at the time, I was working the International Harvester Company.
Yeah.
I went there because that's the only job I could get, and I got that through a bloke in customs that knew Dad. He said, how's the young lad settling in? And Dad had a bit to do with him through Good Durant and Murray when he worked there. He said, oh, he's having trouble getting a job. He said, I'll see if I can get him a job. So he rang Dad up, and he said, I've been in touch with the chap at one of the other oil companies. He said, they said, oh, they're looking for a couple of staff there. He said, I'll get an interview. I could mention him to you. So I mentioned him to him. He said, I'll send him in. So I went in there and had an interview with him. He said, oh, I'll get in touch with you again. And he said, oh, your uncle's a judge in the Adelaide Court, isn't he? Charlie Gillespie. I said, yes. And I thought, well, this might get me a bit of work here. Big ass. But anyhow, who told him was his typist or his secretary. I knew her because she married a fella called Tom McGovern. I went to Ross Trevor, and he was a DFC winner and a prisoner of war. But anyhow, she must have said, oh, I know him well. She said, oh, do you know him well? She did. He went to school at Victor Harbour with Tom. That he said he left and went to Ross Trevor a couple of years before Laurie, and from there he went to the university, and then he before he graduated he joined the Air Force. So he said, oh, that's interesting. He said, he seemed to be a nice lad, sort of thing. So he said, all right. Anyhow, he rang me up when I was at applied for it while I was still trying to teach someone the job in Torrens Drill Hall. And he said, at the present moment, Mr. Gillespie, the only thing I offer you, he said, is work down at Birkenhead. He said, that's down in the where we empty all the oil drums and set from that. He said, in the section where they're cleaning all the oil drums and making them suitable for use again, because, you know, metal's short and drums and all that sort of thing. And I thought, well, that's a long way to work your way up from. Didn't say anything to him. I thought, well, no, I think I'd, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. I forgot, know his name, still remember it. I said, I think I'd give that one a miss, thanks. I'd try to get away a bit better from there. I said, I'm doing accountancy, you know, when I get out at the uni, part-time at the uni. I said, I want something relative to accountancy and that. So I said, all right. He said, I can understand that. He said, but he said, unfortunately, he said, most of those positions have been filled there. So away we went from there. So in the meantime, the other bloke...
International Harvester, was that right?
Yeah, International Harvester. Well, he used to call on International Harvesters because he was in the customs duty and used all their parts and things like that. He said, the parts manager's looking for a part there. He said, how do you like that job? I said, well, I'll handle that, all right. He said, I know all about the parts game and that, even though the parts individually, because that was our game. And anyhow, he went down there and I was still in uniform and he interviewed me. And Casbolt was his name, Mr. Casbolt. And I went to school with a boy that his daughter married, actually, Norm Casbolt's daughter-in-law. Anyhow, I went down in uniform and he said, oh, well, he said, you look, it's all right, you've got good references and things like that. I said, I've been used to spare parts for a fair while, too, I said, because actually I always liked that because there was somewhere where I was getting experience in something in the automotive trade. Mm. So I said, well, we'll start you off here. He said, you'll be on the records. I said, well, you can't have to tell me anything about that. So yeah, I went on there and then he saw I wasn't too happy there because the same, it was not there on the similar thing with the British accounting system, and that was brought in from America. Some Yanks came out and showed us that. And those are the trays where you pull the trays out. And everything was in there, nothing to do with ledgers in trays, and then things that had to be ordered and back ordered, they were in telescopic things around the table, and one bloke was handling his lot there, and no one else did it but him. So anyhow, I went there and I stayed there, and the only other thing I wanted to be, I was very interested in sales, mm-hmm. And I think I'd like to do something in sales. But then they had, damn me if they didn't advertise in the paper for a sales rep, in knowledge of spare parts and all that sort of thing, and being there about could have been 12 months, might 9 to 12 months, and I met a girlfriend while I was there too, and anyhow I this is 12 months from. Yeah, I said, I took the job there. Anyhow, they went there, and that's right. And I went to Casbolt, the parts manager. I said, look, I said, they're advertising for a representative, sales representative out of ISIS, Industrial Sales and Service out at Dawes Road. And they were the International Harvesters tractor people, mm-hmm. Whereas that one there was tractors, but they were industrial tractors, I'm sorry. And they were the... anything to do with the farm, trucks and all that, plus tractors. But that one out there was all industrial and other machinery, which I thought, well, that'd be all right. There's all parts, there's only one engine, diesels and all that sort of thing. So I went out there, and the chap said, well, he said, why don't you start in the parts department here? He said, you'll be the 2IC. I said, oh, that's good, isn't it? Starting the way 2IC. He was an ex-prisoner of war, actually. And he said, no, we'll get another staff here. He said, there'll be two of you there. So I said, I think I'd enjoy it out here. So I went back to, that's right, Casbolt told me that. He said, look, he said, I know you're keen to get away from this. He said, you're interested in parts. He said, would you be interested in a job out at Industrial Sales and Service? He said, they're advertising out there for parts man. That's why I went out as a parts man, not a salesman.
So this led to a long civilian career, and we can perhaps explore that in a slightly different way later. What I'd just like to do, really, just to wrap the interview up, I'd just like to just take you back
I'll get you a cup of coffee.
Let's do that in a minute. First of all, I want a final thought from you, Laurie. You served your country. What is your lasting memory of what you achieved in terms of being a serviceman? What does it mean to you to be a World War II veteran?
Yeah. Well, this is a point that I'm telling you about that happens to a lot of Corps troops. they always feel that they weren't in the field.
Right.
Now, it's all very well to put up with bombing and strafing and prisoners of war and all that sort of business. The only after effects, as far as we can see it, is that the other boys, even though they risk their lives, they're somewhere for 3 months, that's unless they were at Tobruk or made prisoners of war and all that sort of thing. But they're always inclined to downgrade you a bit. And I'll tell you, when we went to, I'm not going to dwell on this one, but when we went to, I nearly had the name of that bloody town,
Albury. We went around Bagabunyal, Bonnyville, but Albury.
And that's where all the courses were done out there.
Right.
So we went out there, and when we went on to the station, and during that course, there would have been, as I said, probably 24, a couple of dozen at least, and all sergeants. All snakes upwards, the warrant officer and some officers there too. So when we went to catch the train in the station, they marched us onto the station, and of course when we marched, we had all our gear and things like that because we were going to do exercise and drill and all that sort of thing. We walked down and we're coming down the train and we're all marching left, right, and of course it was perfect as we were told we had to do when we went to the officers' training school, because we all had to take over squads and take the place of an officer in that. And as we were marching down, the bloke said, "Have a look at the bloody zebras." He said, "Where the hell are they going?" And that's as they called it. And of course, I said, "Oh, it's on again." And there we were, and they all running in Chayak, and as you see, and I thought, well, that's the sort of thing. They saw the colour patch, you see.
Sure.
Someone said they're ordnance boys. So in the, apparently, during the, they called them caterpillars.
You served. You served.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we served, yeah.
And you roughed it up in New Guinea. It was not Holland Day by any means.
We all knew. We had a couple of suicides in our uniform, and all young lads. One was married, one was single.
So the lasting memory you have, the sentiment, the feeling that you have, having served in New Guinea, what does it mean to you today to look back and reflect on that?
Well, that you served, that's the only thing. The family say, "I never talk about it much." I said, "No, not a great deal to talk about." I said, "All you talk about is when you and Kingy get together and we have a picnic and that." She said, "Well, then you're carrying on about everybody." And the girls just sit back and listen, you see. And the kids say, "Well, there's nothing to tell them much about it there." I said, we got in the place and we had to stay there for a fair while and then move on.
You did your job.
When we did move on, now when we went to Moresby, I was sent on to Lae.
Yes.
And Teddy King was sent on, and Murray had to stay behind because they wouldn't let him go. And I said to Ted, "I hope we can get together," and we couldn't even get in the tent together.
So I think the lasting memory I have, just thinking about what you're saying to me now, is of mateship, and that was important to you.
That's just what was coming on to, the mateship. And this is one thing that wasn't over strong, never a strong unit. And that's why for 2 years down there, I've marched like the only one with my grandson. Gave him some ribbons to put on the right.
Anzac Day march.
He loved that, yeah. And then one year I wouldn't march because I felt a bloody idiot walking along, and they had two standard bearers because the ammunition packed up. They didn't go there at all, only a single line for a long while. So they had the Ordnance Corps thing and the ammunition and then the Union Jack in the centre. Then someone else got an ordnance flag made, and it was about the size of, bigger than that bloody window. And when the Vietnam boys took it over, well, it just is bigger than that because they couldn't hold it up in the bloody procession. But anyhow, and there, and it was just a matter of all this bloody, limelight around me, and I'm marching on my bloody own.
I think I should ask you, just to wrap things up, you were marching on your own, you're a great survivor. You are a man now. We're doing this talk today, and you are 94, going on 95.
You're 95 in December.
Mm. You're in remarkable shape.
Oh, well, that's what I say. All the glistens isn't gold. Don't get me on what my troubles have been, because I won't give them to you. I've had everything. But I'm being well looked after by DVA. That's the sort of thing.
Thank you so much for talking to us today.